We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Styles McKenzie helping you make those rooms sing. Today's style tip. When it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild, like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Arr, fierce. This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
Should GLP-1 weight loss medication like Wegovy and Zepbound cost thousands of dollars? We don't think so. Try LifeMD.com helps provide insurance access to the leading GLP-1 medications. Visit TryLifeMD.com and check your eligibility for GLP-1 medication with copays as low as $0. Listen to Bridget's story after losing 55 pounds and using her insurance for coverage.
LifeMD helped me get covered with my insurance. Finding out that it was covered was huge. I've lost 55 pounds. I am so much healthier now that I've lost the weight. I would never be able to do it without them.
Get started today and check your eligibility for GLP-1 medication with copays as low as $0 at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
Greetings, travelers.
Greetings, travelers.
Oh my gosh, you had to sing again.
Of course I had to sing again. I'm just saying, you know why I started singing today? Because I got another email from X, which we'll have to read for a listener. Yes.
Oh
and
my
it is actually a very flattering email. Normally I don't read these things, but I needed to read it because I just didn't know if the end was nigh, as
our good
friend Rick Hines would say.
We hadn't heard from him in a little while, or her, or whatever. So yeah,
them.
We haven't heard from them in a while. We'll leave it at that. Yeah. So yeah.
Yeah.
I'm excited to read that one. So yeah. Good.
I thought Mark. Don't you have some breaking news?
Let's hear the music. Yes. We have a few breaking news stories, but we're going to keep it short. I'm just going to do one real quick that we found a wonderful store in Asheville that is called Pearls Yarn, and it's just a knitting store, but they also do cryptids, and they have cryptid-themed yarn, and they also have a cryptid... themed yarn themed tarot deck. One side is yarn and crafting, and then the other side is cryptids. So feel free to use that as you will. We'll link them in the show notes. They're amazing. They were wonderful people. Follow them on Instagram and all the socials. We'll put that link to that in there. But that cryptid themed deck, I'm just like, oh my gosh, what happens if I draw the inverted Jersey Devil? Or I wonder what that means.
That's not bad. I don't know. We're not getting into tarot and oracle deck reading right now. We have too exciting of a show today, Mark.
Oh my gosh, yes. That's why I had to keep that brief. But yes, we have a special guest today. And this special guest is also a big fan of one of my favorite movies. And I stumbled upon them on a podcast talking about this amazing movie. And I'm like, oh my gosh, this person gets it. But Erica hasn't seen that movie or knows anything about it. So I'm bringing on this special guest to help me motivate you to see this movie, Erica. I know it's tough to get you to watch some of these spooky things sometimes.
That's not the problem, Mark. I'm going to let you introduce our special guest. The problem is what you consider a good movie and what I consider a good movie tend to be very different things. Bubba Hotep. That is all I'm going to say about that at this moment in time.
Uh-oh.
That's 2 hours of my life I will never get back in this world.
Wait a minute. That is one of the best movies of all time. All right. But anyway, let's bring on our guest. This is one of the people I love and adore her work. I've only seen one of her films, sadly, but she is amazing to watch in her performances and stuff that I've seen online. I'm excited to meet her now virtually face to face. Please welcome Anastasia Elfman.
Woo! Yay! Yay! Hello, hello.
Hello.
And did you hear that blasphemy backstage?
Yeah. I sure did.
I was going to say, I'm glad I could start off offending you about Bubba Hotep to begin with. So, here's my problem with Bubba Hotep is that I love Bruce Campbell. I do. But I felt like the pacing of that movie and some of the stuff, I was just like, this could go a little faster. Maybe if I watched it on 1.5 or 2, it would be okay. But there were some long drawn out scenes where
I think I showed it to you too late at night. I think that was the problem. So you were half asleep.
That was not accurate. Anyway.
Well, anyway, enough about that. Let's talk about Anastasia. Anastasia, well, introduce yourself to our eerie travelers.
Oh, well, hello, travelers. I'm Anastasia Elfman. I do everything. I'm an actress. I produce. I direct. I'm classically trained in ballet and cello. I grew up in the theater. I'm a massive horror fan, and I love Lon Chaney Sr. He's my idol. We share a birthday, which is on Tuesday, April 1st, of course, April Fool's Day. And so I like to visit him because he's out here. I live in Hollywood under the Hollywood sign, and he's close by. So I go pay my respects and visit him on our birthday.
Okay, so I gotta ask, good horror, what was your first introduction into horror?
What was my first? Well, I kind of like grew up with a big focus on film and learning film history and stuff. My parents were both like military Marines turned kind of like hippie-ish, and with my like mom was a writer and stuff, and so we watched a lot of like classic horror films and classic films in general. The one that I remember the most as my first would be Lon Senior's 1925 Phantom of the Opera, and that one kind of catapulted me into that world. And also, like a kid who grew up with severe dyslexia, I always kind of felt like a monster, an outsider. And so that kind of gave me, I don't know, like a family, feeling like part of a unit, if that makes sense. Like there are others, and then those type of people love horror. And so I ended up making friends like at the local rental, like VHS rental store, you know?
Oh yeah, no, video store. Me and Mark lived in those. For those youngins listening, travelers, make your parents show you what a VHS look like. Google that. It's fun.
Yeah, Google that. But, or yeah, watch the last
way back in the day. I love that you said Phantom of the Opera is a horror. I absolutely adore that you said that.
It is. The original is true horror. Oh my gosh. It's incredible. And it's the 100th anniversary of that, you know.
Yeah, this year. Yes.
So, yeah, well, when you go by and see Lon, I know he's in that unmarked.
Yes. Grave, yes. So. Yes. I'm very respectful to the family's wishes, and I stay out of that area, but I know where he is. So I, you know, kind of tip my hat and give him all the love, because he's the reason that I got into performing and creating and just learning about him and his history and everything that was against him. You know, like very basic stuff is like both of his parents were deaf mutes, and so he had to deal with a lot of like overcoming a lot of things. So I just feel a very like close fondness with him and his career and everything like that. Like we both started out as dancers, and we do like choreography and started out doing comedies and things like that. So, you know, I love him. Very biased.
Highly recommend, what was it? The Man with a Thousand Faces. James Cagney tells his story, and it's fairly authentic. It's a little goofy, Hollywood upped, but if you don't know his story, it's a good way to get the basic.
I mean, kind of. It didn't really hit all of the things. I mean, he's known for doing all of his own makeup. They give that to like a Westmore credit. You know, it's Lon 1,000%. So like, yeah. But I'm a nitpicker.
Understood. Well, good. This is perfect, then. This is perfect. So, all right. So, you've done now. What are some of the stuff you've done? One of my favorites Was it Aliens, Geeks, and Clowns? Or Alien, Clowns, and Geeks?
Aliens, Clowns, and Geeks. Yeah, my husband wrote and directed that. His older son, Bodie Elfman, stars in that film. And I just kind of played like 6 or 7 side characters. Yeah. And also because I did like makeup and props and costumes. So I did second unit. I did a lot of those. So like, if you see a foot, it was probably my foot in that scene. What else? So yeah, I just play a lot of different random characters in that.
That movie had a very, a fried berry type of atmosphere to it, which is another, just one of those obscure movies that I'll never get Erica to watch. It's just, it's a wild movie and a lot of fun. And it's everything you'd think from the title. So.
Yeah. And more.
That, you're making me sound like an elitist. That is not accurate.
No,
I'm just
agreed. And, I mean, I got you to watch a few others that you've enjoyed. So
yes, and Bo will even testify to this as well. Yeah, you know, we're both there for Bubba Hotep and other things. There, you have like a hit or miss. You've got a 50-50. Well,
you enjoyed Pontypool. I'll give you that. So that was good. Yes. So we were watching it in a cabin in the woods in Kentucky, waiting for the Mothman Festival. So it was a lot of fun.
Wild.
Yeah, sometimes it's about the atmosphere you present something in, right? So, okay, now you were on a couple podcasts, I think, discussing the same movie. At least I saw one of them.
Yes, I mean, I love deep diving horror films. My favorite thing is like kind of because I've been going through the film festival circuit with our newer horror film called Bloody Bridget, which I star in and I produce and help finance. And so I've been meeting a bunch of like wonderful podcasters. And so we'll do an interview about like myself or like Rick, my husband. And so we'll do it together. And then the podcasters will find out that I'm actually this huge like cinephile and I love talking about horror films. And so they'll book me just on my own to like pick out my favorite movie. And so, I've deep dived The Uninvited maybe twice before, but I always feel like, you know, when you're dealing with talking with other people, it's like you don't always get all of your thoughts out. And so I feel like I can always talk about my favorite films, you know, and then it gives them like, I can use my little soapbox and just talk about how amazing they are. And now I'm a little bit worried that Erica hasn't seen it because there's definitely going to be some things that are spoiled. And I wish you would have watched it beforehand because I'm an elitist and it's such a wonderful film.
No, but
some of our listeners aren't going to have seen it either, which is the whole point of this is let's get everybody to watch this amazing film. So let's say the first half before the break here, we will not talk spoilers as best we can. There will still be some things that are going to slip out. Then when we come back from the break, we'll do spoilers. So, but before we get started, then let's have you do a little bit more. Tell us about Bloody Bridget then before we get started on that. Then, so. That way, in case they don't tune back in at the end, you know, we can promote your new project.
Mark, why are our travelers leaving us? You're done. You're done now.
They're going to stop. Anastasia, and then they're going to watch the movie.
About your amazing movie.
They'll stop. They'll watch the movie and then they'll come back. That'll give them a nice place to pause.
So. See, that's what I would recommend because I don't even like people watching the official trailer for The Uninvited because I feel like they spoil too many things because there's certain crucial plot points that are revealed just in the trailer for the film, which I hate when films do that. I try to avoid trailers. I actually walk out of movie theaters when they're doing the trailers and then I come back to watch the films because I feel like, especially nowadays, they're just like giving away the monsters. And I'm like, why am I even like going and spending hundreds of dollars to go see a movie in theater if I'm just going to see the monster right now? But yeah, reeling it back in, Bloody Bridget, my husband Richard Elfman wrote, directed, produced that film. It's about, gosh, how do I explain it? My character is Bridget O'Brien, and she's kind of like a, I don't know, I would say kind of like a hopeless romantic dreamer who wants to produce these kind of like wonderful little burlesque pieces, but she's down on her luck and everybody's taking advantage of her. She's in Van Nuys and she has an abusive boyfriend who's cheating on her. She has an abusive boss who's just taking advantage, and then she kind of like, she's down on her luck, and she ends up meeting like kind of a voodoo deity, Salmon. She ends up meeting him and in the underworld, and kind of gets this power to become a Valentine vampire. And she's like, oh, what's that? And he's like, you shall see. And so she ends up going around and seeking justice and kind of ripping out like the people who did her wrong and saving women from being attacked. She rips out their heart and eats it in front of them. So it's kind of a fun film. And that's me back there.
I love that.
As Bloody Bridget. Yeah.
I love vengeance characters. Like Mark will tell you, my favorite cryptids, my favorite spooky things are anything that is a female that's on a vengeance mission. One of my favorite things in the world. I'm going to love that movie.
Yeah, yeah. She's like empowered and the sword of justice, and she's just kicking ass and taking people's hearts. And actually, I mean, usually I do, like, my husband, Rick, he does the spiel. So sorry, that was a little, like, choppy.
It was perfect.
Usually I'm just sitting there, and then they ask me, like, what's my favorite scene and things like that. So.
Well, what is it coming out?
It's not out yet. We're talking with distributors. It's all like 100% self-financed. So we're kind of looking for the right fit. We've been touring with it to different film festivals from the south of Brazil to Canada and everywhere in between. And we generally, Rick and I, we travel with the film. And we put on these vaudeville-esque live pre-show events. So I come out as the character, and I have a victim in the audience, and I literally rip out the beating heart of an audience member and eat it on stage. So it's a fun time. And we had a screening event in LA where I got to, my victim was Bloody Bridget film producer, Brian Usna, who's a huge horror icon. And so I got to rip out his heart before the film. So it's a really fun time. I love producing these kind of live screening events. I've done them for like, what was it? For Jodorowsky's Santa Sangre, they flew me out to the Mexico City for the 30th anniversary screening. And so because I have a very strong background in props and costume design, so I can make costumes that are screen accurate. And then for that one particularly, I devised a system where I actually take off my arms and there's blood, and I performed. It was part of a film festival, and it was in front of like a huge elephant. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that film, but it's like an iconic film, Santa Sangre, which I love. And so I got to perform in front of the like cast and crew and the Jodorowsky family. So that was a huge moment. But I performed in front of a huge elephant casket in like this holy cathedral in Mexico City, on point, because I'm a ballerina. So one of the characters like is kind of like has a ballerina moment. So it was fun to bring that to life. Yeah.
Yeah, that William Castle would be very proud promoting your films like that.
So. Yes, yes. I mean, he's one of my main inspirations for kind of doing these like live kind of like hijinks, you know, like I love keeping, I mean, this day and age, you've got to have a gimmick to get the audience into the theater. And so I've found I feel like I don't want to give other people ideas, but I feel like right now I'm the only one who does these like very exact dramatic performances in front of films. Like I have a Suspiria one, I have a Joe Dante's The Howling, I have one of those where I literally transform in the moment into a werewolf. And so I love creating these kind of things because I'm like very OCD and I love to like make it very screen accurate and give that performance and also use the score from the film. So I like to do a full immersive experience, if that makes sense.
Oh yeah.
No, it does. But now I got to ask, did you ever do Rocky Horror? Cause I did so much Rocky Horror.
No, I never did.
Yeah.
But,
the audience. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, now we got to get one for Bubba Hotep.
Those groups have done my husband's film Forbidden Zone. So they've like shadow casted that. Wow. But what I do is very different from shadow. Wow. I don't shadow cast. I do a live pre-show performance that's very immersive. And it's just for like, it's just to like set the stage work for like what they're going to experience with the film. If that makes sense. It's just like totally. To bring the audience in and have just an elevated experience that I feel like nobody else is doing, which I hope nobody else does.
No, I think that's yours. Now you mentioned elevated. So that's what we will talk about with our movie, because I think The Uninvited is the epitome. I guess it was the earliest that I know of what we would call elevated horror. I think.
Okay, explain what that means, Mark, to our lovely audience.
I don't want to make it sound snobbery or anything, but I think up until this point, you remember the 1930s, Universal owned horror, basically. They had all the monsters. They had Dracula and Frankenstein, and they were not afraid of showing you the Bride of Frankenstein, Invisible Man. All that came out way before this, and they had dominated Hollywood. And ghosts were pretty much screwball comedy stuff. I mean, Topper had come out where it was kind of a friendly ghost, kind of Casper style. And then Abbott and Costello, Meet the Ghost. You know, that's the level ghost movies were at. I think even Buster Keaton way back had done, you know, goofy ghost stories. So true. And or it was the, what they call it, the Old Dark House, which was Universal's ghost story, but it wasn't a ghost. It was like a Scooby-Doo ending. There was weird family. There were murders. There was this, but it was a Scooby-Doo ending. The ghost was, you know, oh, it's the old man in the mask, stuff like that. So this was the first movie that took ghosts seriously, I think. I mean, there might be others, but this is the one that really hit. So, but again, it wasn't done for laughs. It wasn't done for gore. It was done for scares. And I think that's what we talk about elevated horror now, is the kinds that are the slow burn and build up, although this really isn't that much of a slow burn as a movie. Especially, I just recently went back and read the original novel, and man, talk about slow burn. It definitely shows its age of being written in the late 1930s, early 1940s. Okay, we'll talk about the novel a little bit later.
You led this. Anastasia, what is the elevator pitch for this movie? What's it about?
I mean, okay, I'm trying to think how to explain it without doing spoilers. Basically, it kind of opens up with a narration, and then we go to kind of a brother and sister that are exploring, I guess it would be like the English countryside, oceanside in this case. And they kind of stumble upon a forgotten estate mansion. They call it a house, but it's really like this huge property with numerous rooms. It's so gorgeous. I love it. And they kind of walk around. They're going after their dog that ran into the house after a squirrel. And then they end up looking around the house and they're like, oh, this must be for sale. And so they try to buy the house, but there's mystery happening. And I don't know. I mean, how do you explain this film without giving away too much? I would consider it kind of like a dark-rooted thriller, but it's also a romance, it's a comedy, it's so many things. And I think that it's just wonderful how the director, it's just seamless the way that it ebbs and flows, and the score is so gorgeous, and how it's just so like light and fluffy, and then it's dark. You know, yeah. We hit so many notes, just effortless. It's an effortless watch, but also it commands your attention. There is so much storytelling happening in this film that if you look away on your phone for 2 minutes, you've lost crucial plot points. And it's interesting when you think about this film being released, you didn't have home viewing. I wonder how like audiences were able to, I feel like it would have taken like 2 or 3 watches to really appreciate this film. You know, it feels like in this day and age, it would almost be multiple films, like at least 3, because for me, I would like to see the prequel of, you know, the husband and the wife and the model, let's say, and that kind of love triangle. And then I love what I see now. And then I would like to see what happens after the fact, because it's kind of alluded to different things. But that's kind of what I would love to see as a viewer.
I would love to see, you know, Ryan Murphy's team that did The Haunting of Hill House and Haunting of Bly Manor and Fall of Usher do something with this, because there is so many different characters and so many different plots from the book that didn't make it to the movie. And then,
oh yes, I'm so interested, because I'm right now I'm in the middle of, because I'm a huge horror fan, especially classic horror. So I just finished like Dracula. I did The Invisible Man. I've been reading a lot of these novels just to get a better scope and better understanding. And it's so interesting because they're so different from what we know of the classic horror, the film. The novels are widely different, and I don't think we've actually seen a true version of the novel, which I would love to write sometime and direct.
I would love to see a proper Dracula done, maybe even found footage style, because that's kind of the way the book is written, is like the snippets, the newspaper articles, and the diaries.
I mean, they definitely go back and forth. Erica, I don't know if you've ever read the novel for Dracula, but it definitely goes back and forth a lot. And it's, I've had to because I listen to a lot of audio because I have severe dyslexia, and just my life, I don't have time to sit down and read. Like, I'm a mother and I'm a wife and I'm also like a working actress and performer. So I just don't have time. But so, yeah, with Dracula, it's so back and forth, you know.
Yeah, there was.
Are we talking about Bram Stoker's Dracula?
Yeah, Bram Stoker's
Dracula. Of course.
Yeah, I did read that. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I was like, what are we talking about? Because I'm assuming
we digressed.
What?
We digressed there. Sorry.
Yeah, I was like, okay, where are we going? So, Mary Shelley's elevator bit for the. Mary Shelley's Frankenstein?
Yeah, the original. This is amazing. Yeah. And again, I don't think it's ever properly been adapted.
Yeah, what is the original Invisible Man?
Isn't it like H.G. Wells?
Yeah, H.G. Wells wrote Invisible Man. Yeah. Yeah. Again, the movie is fantastic. But
I love what they did with the movie. I mean, it's definitely different and it's like artistically changed for film, which I know a lot of directors do that kind of stuff. It's like the freedom within to create, but it's definitely different than the novel that I read. Yep. It actually almost doesn't even touch on that. It's like very vague, like whiffs of the film, let's say.
Yep. And that's kind of what this book is to this movie, is there's parts of the book that were adapted into the play version of this. The original author, Dorothy McCardle, she was a playwright. And her story is about a playwriter, not a composer, like in the movie. A playwright who, he and his sister are looking for a cheap house outside of London, and they've explored a bunch of places. They don't find what they're looking for because they can't afford just about anything. And they stumble again upon kind of this unusual place, and they love it. They fall in love with it for no reason. It's falling apart. It needs work. But they make an offer, and the man who's selling the house is like, yes, I'll take it. I mean, they purposely make a low ball offer, the lowest ball of low ball offers. And he's like, I'll take it. And they immediately go, that's odd. Is there something wrong with it? Do we need to check the floorboards or do you have a ghost? And the man's like, I take the offer or leave it. And so they take the offer. They like, no more questions. They get up there. Strange things happen at, Cliff View. And in the book, but in the movie, it's called Windward. No reason to change. And then strange things start happening. There's a young girl involved. And again, like you said, in the movie, it changes course several times. In this, it changes course several times. They invite their friends up from London and have a big office party, you know, housewarming party after they've rebuilt the place. And again, strange things have happened, but they're hoping new people will provide things. But at the party, strange things happen. This was totally cut out of the movie. And then, so okay. Like I said, I think there's more to this.
We're going to do a commercial real quick, and then we can come back, because if you say strange things happen without a little more detail one more time, the travelers are going to lunge. Just kidding. Yep. And with that, we'll be right back after this word from our sponsors.
Prepare to be devoured. The Wolves of Wharton is a 6-part complete book series by Erie Travels producer Beau Lake. It has been called dark and visceral, steamy, dramatic, and a fresh take on the werewolf mythos. If you like action, adventure, a large serving of body horror, and some steamy relations, the Wolves of Wharton series is for you. Pick it up wherever books are sold or at linktree.com/Beau_Lake.
Hi, Drew and Jonathan Scott here, reminding you that a lot of life's firsts are better with help from American Family Insurance, like your first home expansion or your first big lightning strike. There's a first for everything. Get the right home policy at the right price with the right help from American Families agents. Life's better when you're under American Families roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
And we're back. We're back. Okay, so let's start these strange things happening.
Okay. Now, we'll, spoilers, if you haven't watched it, you have only yourself to blame at this point. So
I'm right. Thoroughly blaming myself.
All right. Anastasia, now let's get into this. Let's talk the uninvited. Oh my gosh. Okay. One quick thing about production of this that I'm going to just say right off the bat. They originally pitched this to Alfred Hitchcock to direct. He had just come off of Rebecca, which has a lot of similar themes, which was another gothic book, yes, made into an amazing movie. And a similar character that I think winds up in this movie, that in the book is kind of a lesser character, but in this movie they made her into a much bigger character. And that's Miss Holloway, who we will discuss a little bit. And man, so I think that's why Hitch was like, I just did this and I don't want to do it again. So he pitched a friend of his who had never made a film. He'd only directed a bunch of stage plays and stuff. And that was Lewis Allen. Everybody called him Lou. And then, of course, they cast Ray Milland as the lead, who is amazing. And then they cast young up-and-comer Gail Russell, who we will talk about a little bit in this tragic Hollywood story, as always. But so you can't talk about this movie without talking a little bit about her life. Because of what she was going through while she's making this movie. But, and then, Ruth Hussey. I want to say Olivia because she just passed away, but Ruth Hussey, no relation. She was amazing as the sister Pamela in this. So that's our main cast. Go ahead, Anastasia. Why don't you say a little bit about the kind of that we talked a little bit about the intro. They find the house. We now know strange things are occurring. What are some of the strange things that occur?
Okay, can I just first say that this is like a stab to the heart, just knowing, Erica, that you haven't seen this. Yeah. Just talking about it.
No, it's okay.
Well, I hope you watch it at some point, because it definitely deserves. I mean, it's kind of one of those things that's under the radar that I feel like this film needs to be talked about, because like what you were saying, Mark, that it's so crucial to the genre of like the ghost, the haunted house, and kind of like it was only like a Laurel and Hardy joke beforehand, and now it's like, okay, so what do we do if the ghosts are real? And so I kind of like how serious they take the ghosts. It's almost immediately like they're like, okay, what do we do? Like, we've dumped all of our life savings into this. I mean, the house was very cheap, but still, it seems like both of them are just like kind of like working class ends meet. We hear a little bit of a background story about, is it Rick? He like critiques like music or something like that, but he's actually a composer. And so his sister wants him to just give that up and focus on his art, which I think is so wonderful. Gosh, I mean, what else?
The main
There's
thing,
so much. It's hard to like, exactly. It's hard to focus without these like points of reference.
Oh yeah. No, I know you kind of need the cliff notes, but yeah, no, Roderick and Pamela. In the book, he's Roddy, and in the movie, he's Rick. So it's Roderick. They're half Irish. There's this, but it's not really, the movie doesn't really go into that much. Again, this is the book a little bit more. And in that, he's a critic of play. And Dorothy McCardle, the author, she was a playwright. And so I think this is kind of self-insert in her. And the few critiques I've read of the book where people didn't like the book and preferred the movie, I think are people who are complaining because the first half of the book is them talking with their play friends and their actor friends. And there's a lot of, oh, this is like this play and this is like this play. And you know, so there's some of that. And I think that's just her showing slice of life every day. But as they start remodeling the house and making it their own, Rick or Roddy has to go back to London to tie up his loose ends, get his day job taken care of so he can keep kind of writing articles for newspapers up there. He's also having a phone line installed. This house is built 1920s. Now, you think it's like 1800s. No, this is 1930s. And this house still doesn't have electricity. And
yeah,
all that.
There's...
So, yeah, that's a big point in the book and the movies. And so he goes down there while the sister starts helping fix up the house. And then they bring their nanny, their childhood nanny who's now grown up, to come help them live with them now. And she's an old Irish nan, Miss Lizzie, and she's fantastic. And she's the one with the cat. She brings a cat. And you will love the cat's name, Erica.
Okay.
The cat's name is Whiskey.
Oh, so, I do love that.
So, because she likes her Irish whiskey. So that's her spirits, is her cat. So they come up to the house. They've been gone a few weeks. The sister, Pamela, has made it beautiful. She's decorated it. And all this, and they're like, wow, this is amazing. And Lizzie Flynn is loving it because it's like an old country home and she's excited to cook in the big kitchen and all that. And they spend their first night, but the sister's been there a while. And on the first night, he hears someone crying and Roderick, this is the book and the movie are from basically Rick's point of view. And he gets up wondering, oh my gosh, my sister's crying or somebody's crying, but he can't find the source of the crying. And that's when the sister comes out and is like, oh, you hear it too. I thought I was going crazy.
Yeah, it's like wailing. Actually, she's like, this is old hat. This has been happening. Let me tell you, it's been a week. I've been alone in this mansion, just trying to get by. And this ghost is keeping me up at night. But also, we kind of like just went past, there was an interesting like moments when the brother and sister are coming to the grandfather's house to buy the home. And then they have a moment with the granddaughter who is so attached to this house and does not want it to be sold. And so she kind of tries to tell them a lie, like, oh, no, 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 it's not for sale. And then all of a sudden her grandfather comes in and is like, what are you talking about? Like, it's totally for sale. It's, I don't have money to keep this going. And so he kind of like sells it against her wishes. And then kind of that's, we find out that there's a reason why she doesn't want it sold, because it was her mother's home, you know? And so she's connected. Yeah, she's connected to that house. And so she doesn't want anybody to live there.
And that's an opposite of the book. In the book, she wants it sold because she's been
told. Oh, how
interesting. Well, she should never go there. And so she's afraid of the house.
So interesting. I mean, I don't want you to give me all the plot points because I want to read it.
That is one major difference. But then again, a big thing in this book is not everything is what it seems. And not everybody is saying what they mean. There are layers and layers of character and stories that have, you know, how we talk folklore and legends, Erica, and how one person tells a story and then the next person hears that and then they tell the story and then they tell the story. That's one of the big themes in this. And that's also in the book, is that plays are versions of stories and they may not be the real version of what happened. And that becomes a major point in the book and the movie. So, but yes. And so we meet Stella, the young 18-year-old in the book, 20-year-old in the movie, just because they didn't want her age difference with Ray Milland to be quite so present. In the book, Rick and her are like 5 years apart. He's like 25. He just came off a very bad relationship. And so now he's meeting this 18-year-old cutie, but he's trying to just, no, she's a young child. But he's got obvious feelings, and that's part of the book. So that's where the romance kind of starts coming in.
Yes. I mean, I feel like personally, I feel like the granddaughter, Stella, she's like very stunted because she's so, the grandfather is so overbearing and just trying to control her entire life. I mean, she still lives with him. She can only go out for church or to run like these like little tiny errands. And she's so afraid of him in that way. So that's kind of an important like character thing as well.
Yeah, and she had been raised in a school far away and only recently returned herself because her grandfather is in failing health. So she's kind of helping take care of him. He's kind of watching her. The mother was this saint of a woman, this amazing woman. Everybody who talks about her, she was the grand dam of the village, this little village. And never told a lie, never did anything wrong. And poor little Stella is growing up in the shadow of this woman who was taken from the world cruelly too soon. And her room is basically a shrine to her mother. There's a statue of her mother in the book, in the movie, it's a portrait. And her father was an artist. And he had painted her mother many times. And so there's portraits of her mother throughout the movie and the book, but he had another, and now we're going to get a little into spoilers, but not too much more, but we're just going to say he had another model. And that is what caused a terrific row at some point. And that's the gossip of the village that our wonderful Rick stumbles on. He's his first trip in town, and goes to the shop, and it's actually word for word from the movie, from the book. And he goes and he's buying some stuff for his house, and he sees postcards of the house. And he's like, oh, I'll take all the ones you got. And the shopkeeper's like, oh, I've got about a dozen of those. And he's like, oh, strange doings at that place. And he basically tells them the mother died there tragically. No one really knows the story, but fell from the cliff. You know, the tragic Gothic end. But then some people had rented the place later but they weren't good people. That's why they left in a hurry and owed debts all over town. So nobody listens to their stories. They made scary stories about the place and no one really pays it mind. But, you know, we know.
Yeah, I thought that was an interesting scene of how to like organically put backstory for the audience to learn, where it's not like slowing down the pace of the main part of the film, but it was like very interesting to watch him like pepper in like this backstory so that we learn as we go and it doesn't, we're not stalling anything, which I love. I love when there's like these creative ways, you know, because like I feel like a lot of things right now were like so weighted down with these like boring subplots of characters I don't care about at all. But this shopkeeper, and then there's also like another patron that comes in and it's like, oh, I would actually, it's like they leave you wanting more. I would actually like to see another scene with them, but we never see them again.
No, they disappear from the book too. But again, it was just, she's like, oh, they bought the house. Ooh, this is, you know, it's like, but it just shows that small town gossip, right? That this town, yes, is throughout this. And there's a character in the book that is a little bigger part in the book than he is in the movie. And that is the town doctor, who is Dr. Scott, which there's your Rocky Horror reference for the day. In the book, he is this young, plucky guy who is he's new to the town. He's only been there about 5 years. I think in the movie he jokes he's only been there 10 years. So he's still a newbie in the town. He just took over for the last doctor who passed away, inherited his practice. He was actually there training under him. And then suddenly he's thrust into the practice. In the book, he intended to leave and go on, but he's very happy he didn't leave because this young couple has moved up the hill, the sister and the brother. He's very happy to find out that she's a sister and not a wife. And so there's kind of implications that he's interested. And it's funny in the book, I will say just one more little difference in the book. He's very smitten with her. And in the movie, we kind of see that play. Dr. Scott in the movie is played by a younger Alan Napier, but not very young Alan Napier, who, for you Batman fans from 66, he played Alfred in 66, just 20 years later. So, you know, he's definitely not the young 20-year-old. He's in his 40s or early 50s when he filmed this. But he's intrigued by Pamela in the movie as well. But in the book, Roderick's talking about his sister, Pamela. She's not interested in boys at all. She's just interested in herself and her hobbies. So I thought that was actually something you don't see much in books of that period, because normally it's all romance.
Well, okay. I will absolutely watch this movie and report back. I promise.
We're only in the first like quarter of the film, by the way.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
There's so much more.
Ahead just a little. We're not going to give away the big reveal. Okay. Anastasia, we'll
avoid. Which one is that?
There's so many big reveals.
There's many.
Yeah. There are a lot of layers of this, but we will say that the story unfolds as the events of the haunting start getting more and more pronounced. Stella visits the house and that escalates things. There's this one room in the house, the studio, which becomes his office, and he plays a beautiful serenade that he's been serenading because he's so infatuated with young Stella. And it's called Stella by Starlight, which becomes a jazz hit. I think every jazz musician at all from the 40s when this movie started all the way to, you know, recent has recorded. Frank Sinatra, Billie Holiday, everybody.
Ella Fitzgerald.
Yeah. And my gosh, Ozzie Davis, who was in Bubba Hotep. But Stella by Starlight is made for this movie. In the book, he's writing a play. And the play is completely different from this. So it's he's basically writing the story of the ghost, not knowing he's writing the story of the ghost.
Oh, so, how wild. Okay. Cool. Yeah. I can't wait to read.
I won't spoil more of that for you then. But you'll read it. You'll be like,
that twice.
Because you've watched the movie.
Mark goes, I'm not going to spoil it, and then spoils it.
That's okay. That's okay. I'll let it pass.
All right. Thank you. Okay, but let's get so as the escalation occurs, there's some great effects in the studio at that point. The lighting goes a little off. His music gets a little sadder, and there's some roses that well, that's an earlier scene in the studio. So there's and they start talking about the feeling of cold and some other things, and they start bringing up some of the science of hauntings and stuff like that into this. So that thrilled me on this. So I as a fan of horror and a fan of science behind parapsychology, they threw that in there, and I was very pleased.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. I mean, some characters go through it's like a dark feeling and a dreadful feeling. And we see that it's kind of like focused in this one room, which I'm forgetting the name of the room, but it's basically where Stella's father would paint. And it's kind of his like art studio, let's say. And so everywhere else in the home is all warm and somewhat cheerful. And then just kind of focus in this one area. It's very like doom and gloom and has an effect on people and their moods when they go into it. And also has a physical effect, like what you were saying, on the flowers, where we get to see that kind of like a quick time lapse moment where the flowers are wilting, and then there's a moment where Stella and Rick are having kind of a little flirty moment, and he's playing that jazz standard Stella by Starlight, and it ends up going dark, and Stella's like, oh, it went sad, why are you turning it so sad? And he says he can't help it, he's not in control anymore, kind of thing. So it's interesting how people are controlled under this. So it's kind of like going back and hearing maybe the stories of these people who didn't want to pay for a house where they're being controlled to do like quote unquote, like maybe evil things. Maybe they're not so bad, but that's such a small part of the film. So it's not a major focus or anything, but.
No. And there's another room where it's an opposite feeling, where everything seems to be happy and everything seems to be wonderful, extremely so. And so that's plays an important part of the book as well as the movie. Now, one thing that was very cool in the movie is they hold a seance to try to figure out what's going on. And they do it old school style, not Ouija board or anything like that. They do the talking glass, which was very popular spiritualism in the 1800s. Which is basically you put the letters around in a circle, you do the yes, no cards, and then you use an upside down wine glass on the table as your basically your planchette. And that's in the book and that's in the movie. And they are completely different, the two. So different characters are involved, let's say, and including a parapsychologist that they bring in, who is not in the movie, but he's in the book. And his story is fascinating. He's a guy, this isn't spoiling anything, it's just a character introduction. He's a lawyer who was taking a case in Ireland where a family bought a house with a poltergeist and they couldn't get their money back. Because nobody believes in poltergeists. Nobody believes in this. And this lawyer goes into the house and has a hellish night. And so he makes it his goal in life is to pass a law that ghosts are real. And if you sell a haunted house, you have to make up for it, or you have to let people know you sell a haunted house. And I think the only state in America that does that is New Orleans and Louisiana. And New Orleans is the only city that enforces that. And if you have a haunted house, you have to tell people. But I think that's mostly so that you can make more money on the property by renting it out. Where instead of the other way around than it would have been then. But I love that that's a character in the book. And I was like, oh man, I would love to see that brought into a proper adaptation of this. Although the movie is amazing and it does hit all the major plot points. So I'm not complaining about the movie at all. It is an amazing movie. And reading the book, I have complaints about the book too. So.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't personally read the book yet. You know that, because we've been talking. But the film is so visually stunning. It's so, I mean, when you watch it, it's such an easy watch. And it seems like just when you're just watching it, it seems like it's so simple. But if you are a fan of filmmaking, you know that like these, the lighting took time and the setups, it all took a lot of time. And this is back in the day when they, like studio heads, like they let artists be artists and they had time to rehearse. And it just, it screams and it totally holds up everything about this, including the like special effects, the animation and all of that. I feel like all of this holds up to today's standards, if not exceeds it. I can't think, I was just talking to my husband, Rick. I can't think of a film, like if you think about any of the films nominated for Oscars, none of them compete visually with The Uninvited. None of them, in my opinion. But I'm an old school, like I love like these classic films and, you know, when people cared about, you know, the film making aspect, let's say.
Yeah,
because it's so beautiful. Everything is beautiful, that like even the animation, all of it, it's just like it's top tier. And then don't get me started on the costuming. I mean, this is like an Edith Head film. Yeah. You know, all the costumes are like chef's kiss, like impeccable, gorgeous. Yeah,
even the lighthearted moments are played perfectly. You know, Ray Milland would go on to win the Oscar the next year, and I think he earned it better for this.
you always think like things like actors or filmmakers or composers that are cheated from the Oscars, and it's like I feel like this film was definitely cheated.
Again, it's still horror, even though it was more elevated. I think it was still horror, so. Academy, nothing to do with this, you know, and it's a shame.
Oh, man, don't get me started. I want to still work, so I've got to be careful, but...
No, that's true. Drew there. Yeah, no, we understand. One of the other things with this, I think, is when they throw the story at you at such a pace, like you said, if you blink, you miss it. And suddenly you're like, oh, my gosh. So one of the characters, Holloway... is this nurse character that is somewhere in her past, right? In the book, it's when the mom died, she had this friend who was a nurse who was taking care of her because the mother had an illness. That's the only flaw this woman had, was this illness. And this nurse was taking care of her and they became best friends and they were going to rule the world together. And she was helping her found her psychological foundation. Now remember, we talked about this recently when we were talking about early parapsychology. This was at the same time of early psychology. So 1930s, Freud and all them are just coming into things. And so this is Holloway is founding her own therapeutic relaxation place. And we know about those, Erica. And in the book, it's very similar. And in the movie, it's even creepier because they decided to basically make her a little more Miss Anders from Rebecca. And I think that's kind of what they did here, was I think they saw how good Rebecca was and said, oh, we need that character in this. And this character's kind of close from the book. So I think that's one reason she got kind of blown up a little more in the movie. And she's played fantastically. Oh, I can't remember the actress. I'm going to have to clackety clack real quick. Cornelia Skinner, who was a secretary who got cast for that.
Back in the day when you could cast a secretary and nobody said anything.
Sadly, you know, like I said, we have to kind of talk a little bit about Gail Russell, who plays young Stella. She plays her she does that kind of lost soul perfectly. And it was because she was basically 18, had just gotten cast by a fluke She's got that great Hollywood story, kind of like, you know, the Schwab's ice cream counter. The producer of this film and was driving, and he picked up a bunch of boys hitchhiking and drove them to a town. And he was like, do you know anybody who should be in pictures? And they're all described this one beautiful girl. And so he called her up and said, you got to show up for an audition. And her mother forced her to go. And she was a very quiet girl, wanted to be an artist. She was studying for art and didn't want anything to do with Hollywood, but her mother was kind of a failed actress. And so she's like, I missed an audition, so you have to go. And it ruined my life, and now you have to do it. And so they kind of forced her into this. She had a terrible time filming this. Ray Milland was apparently coaching her as much as he could, but the director hated her and said she was terrible to work with. But sadly, the movie was a hit. If it hadn't been a hit, she would have disappeared into obscurity, gone back to her little life. But because she was a hit, they put her in movie after movie after movie, and her mother kept making her go. And the only way she could get through shots was by basically taking shots. And she drank herself nearly to death. She got into rehab thanks to John Wayne, of all people. And he cast her again in a movie to the point where his wife demanded a divorce, saying, oh, he's having an affair with her. And he's like, no. And there was no affair, according to everyone. But he just saw what happened to her. He saw a young girl who was on the casting couch too many times. That was his quote. And he said, so he gave her a second chance after she got out of rehab. Sadly, it didn't last. And she died at young age of 36.
Wow.
Which is why I think she's kind of a footnote in Hollywood history. And some of her movies are incredible. And she was just amazing in this. Even if she had a tough time filming it, it's incredible. And it's a very haunting story. So wow. Appropriate for this movie, I think, sadly.
Okay. I will watch this movie. But Anastasia, because we're going to have to wrap soon, but I need to know your top three outside of The Uninvited rewatch horror movies that you will absolutely, if they come on, you have to watch them.
The top three, I mean, that's such a low number. I'm trying to think. I love Death Becomes Her. I love The Thing. And what else do I love? I love Gremlins. So those are my like top three. I love Beetlejuice, the original. Like I could go on and on.
Yes, that's my problem. I try to narrow it down, and Erica knows that's why we have 2-hour episodes sometimes.
yeah, it's hard to consolidate. Right?
I think after Erica watches this, I know spooky time's crazy for all of us. So maybe in winter time we have you back on. And we do a full deep dive on this and go scene by scene.
Oh, yes, please. I mean, I just feel bad that, like, you're sitting here while we're just, like, fanning out about this film. And you're like, what are they talking about? This makes zero sense.
No. Mark has some, like, do you see the shirt he's wearing right now that says Ghostwatch?
Are you familiar with this one?
Do you know what Ghostwatch is?
I don't know.
Okay, so
no, I'm sorry.
Mark, I'll send you a link. I'll send you this shortly
I'll
after.
I'll send you a link, but let me do the very sum up because that's one of the ones I watched. I enjoyed it. So he ended up watching this when he was in London. It's a British movie that appears to be a news podcast about a house this woman and her two daughters that are getting attacked basically by a poltergeist in this house.
I think I've seen this. Okay. This sounds really familiar. Where it's like they're outside and they're like it's news anchors and stuff. Okay. Yeah. I think I've seen this. Yeah.
Okay. It was
I remember liking it a lot.
Okay. Yeah. 1980s. And it was basically their War of the Worlds that caused a panic, because everybody thought it was real. And they used real television personalities for the movie. And great Stephen Volk wrote it. We're going to have to get him on. I'm going to have to talk to him and get him on. He doesn't like to talk about this. He likes talking about all his other work, but we'll sneak him in here somehow. I'll reach out. He owes me. So, but Anastasia, thank you so much. I think we've convinced Erica. I think we've convinced some travelers. And then, like I said, we'll give them time to watch it. And then in the fall sometime or early winter, when it's a little chilled out on the moors.
Yeah, yes. go pick this up. It's a good, I think this is just like a 2K release. I would love a 4K. I would love more like special features, but it's a really nice disc. It's gorgeous art. But yeah, do yourself a favor. Anybody who hasn't watched it, it's a perfect film. I find it a masterpiece. And of course, it's a cornerstone, and it's one of the reasons why we have these haunted house films. You know, it all started from there, taking the ghost seriously, which is so important. Yeah.
We wouldn't have Poltergeist. We wouldn't have Amityville. We wouldn't have any of these movies without this one. And
no, it's like, what if the ghosts are real? You know, and how do we deal with it? That's what we're dealing with this film.
I'm going to have to get you a copy of the book somehow. Anastasia, I'll find a second one. I can't part with mine, but I'll find another.
No. I'm a collector as well. I wouldn't ever imagine taking somebody's collection, but yeah, no, I just have to get on it. I have to do it.
Yeah. I think the original UK release was called The Uneasy Freehold by Dorothy McCardle. And she had been a nonfiction writer and a playwright before this. And she very dramatized, wrote accounts of the Irish wars for independence, and she was on the wrong side, so she spent some time in jail there, and so she wrote about that, and I think she sneaks enough of that into her later works, but this was her first huge novel and spooky, and it's definitely worth a read. So we'll put a link to that as well in the show notes. Anastasia, where else can they find you and follow you? So
I mean, I'm on social media. I'm on Facebook, Anastasia Elfman, and then on Instagram, I'm a little tricky to find. I'm under my stage name, Dahlia DeMont, is where I'd love people to come and find me. I'm on YouTube, TikTok. I have Anastasia.com, all of our films. So my husband's like Forbidden Zone, which we tour around and we do like live screening events, which is very special for fans because it was not available for around like 30 years. And so now to see it in a theater is wild. And then with our other films, Aliens, Clowns, and Geeks, and Bloody Bridget. So all of those are on social media. And yeah, I'm really easy to get a hold of and follow. And all of my goofy stuff talking about horror, my obsession with Lon Chaney Sr., all of that is there.
Awesome.
I'm really excited about Bloody Bridget. I'm just going to say, I'm excited about The Uninvited, but I am super excited about Bloody Bridget. So
I mean, it's a very wacky, wild film. It's if you're a fan of my husband's films, you'll love this too. And it's a lot of practical effects, which I fought for because I love practical effects. I do practical effects professionally. And so it was really great. And then his brother, Danny Elfman, and our friend Ego Plum, who's like the cartoon king. He did like SpongeBob, Cuphead Show, all of the SpongeBob universe and stuff. So like we have a really wonderful, insane score. VFX, we have lovely VFX. It's a great time. So yeah, yay. I'm looking forward to sharing it with everybody because I think it's a really important story to share. And it's really hit the audiences. Like when we travel with it, everybody, it's like, it's such a fun crowd that we get. And it's interesting because with this project, we let the bad guys really be bad guys, which I think audiences aren't used to seeing because it's like a very PC culture right now. And so people aren't used to seeing bad guys, but they get their, you know, they get it in the end with a heart ripping out. So it's perfect. It's very pro, you know, like taking care of business, let's say.
All right. Vengeful ghosts. I love it. I love it. Okay. Anastasia, it's been amazing to meet you. I'm so glad you came on and joined us for this.
Oh, thank you. And thank you for having me and letting me talk about The Uninvited, one of my favorite films. And I'm only sorry, Erica, that you didn't watch it beforehand, because we sound like insane people just like talking about these like minor little points in the film. We didn't even get like halfway through the film. No, so
that's important. We're gonna we didn't go any further for people that haven't watched. So like I said, we're going to give all you travelers a chance to watch this too. You can pick it up. It's not streaming, sadly, anywhere, but you can find the Criterion did an amazing release, and it's pretty cheap for the DVD, and it's not expensive for the Blu-ray, that 2K.
So. But they need to do a new one. We need a 4K. We need more special features. I'm happy to write a forwarding, you know, like this is a fun little booklet, but let's get some more stuff in here, you know?
Yeah. I mean, my goodness. And there's so much more. Like I said, it leads to The Haunting. It leads to so many other movies were inspired by this. And like I said, I'm going to get you the book. So you'll read the book. We'll get Eric to watch the movie, and then we will come back and we will do a full, you know, deep dive.
That's going to be like a 2-hour episode. Are you guys ready? Because I am.
We're all going to take a day off of work. And we're going to do this. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. So I'll just wrap it up then, if that's okay, Erica. Are you perfect? All right. So thank you so much for coming on, Anastasia. Everybody get out, follow her. And she makes appearances on some other podcasts that are wonderful to watch. Her deep dives on horror are amazing to listen to. So we'll share those links as we get them. And thank you, Patreon members, for keeping us afloat. And thank you to our sponsors for putting in those wonderful commercials that we hope you'll all, you know, click on and enjoy. With that said, when you're out there and you're wandering the cliffs of Devonshire and you find just the perfect house, maybe a little rundown, and you make that offer and it's a little inexpensive, just remember, keep your wits about you. Check to see if the dog and cat will run upstairs. And if they won't, you might want to call an exorcist, and we'll see you on the other side.
Hi, Drew and Jonathan Scott here, reminding you that a lot of life's firsts are better with help from American Family Insurance. Like your first home expansion or your first big lightning strike. There's a first for everything. Get the right home policy at the right price with the right help from American Family's agents. Life's better when you're under American Family's roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.